This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hey there, here's another mind-rocking show for you. This week I got hammered by some awful news from some great climate science, so I took my troubles to the University of Ottawa climate scientist Paul Beckwith. We get a cutting-edge education. Then we'll try and heal with real food you can grow yourself. Our guest, Caleb Warnock, is a best-selling author. He tells us how humans fed themselves without fossil fuels for centuries. We hear how you can grow food year-round, including during cold winters and summers made hotter by global warming. Take the green way out with Radio EcoShock. We read relentless headlines about our planet heading out of control. Most of them seem to cruise by without hurting us too deeply. Yeah, half the mammals will be extinct soon. The oceans are dying. Scientists declare Earth a toxic planet. Wait, did somebody say it's going to be too hot to hold outdoor music festivals? That's terrible. I love those. My theory is that we all have triggers and breaking points, especially when it comes to climate change news. A couple of mine arrived this week. Now I'm freaked out again. And that means it's time to call our Radio EcoShock regular correspondent, University of Ottawa scientist Paul Beckwith. Paul teaches climate science at the university. He also teaches it to the world via his many YouTube videos. Paul Beckwith, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
You bet. Well, you know, no doubt we're all going to need a climate helpline pretty soon. When we get worried, we'll call up and get a climate counselor. How about you, Paul? Do you get freaked out by climate news sometimes?
I do from time to time, but I try to compartmentalize. And although, you know, I do spend a lot of time, you know, reading papers and doing research on all of the changes that are happening. So, you know, I have to make sure I take breaks from it, you know, take a few days off from time to time, no social media, no work, you know, go to a bunch of movies, spend time with the family and kids, you know, go somewhere, do sort of everyday stuff. But yeah, it does get to you. But I think, you know, I've been doing it for long enough now, I've kind of figured out how to sort of keep it not from affecting me personally too deeply or emotionally or anything like that.
Well, there have been recent studies showing more and more people are feeling climate stress, and we don't need science to watch this all happening literally in our backyards. For example, Paul, in this year of 2017, the city of Chicago had no snow in January and February. That's got to be pretty crazy for people who know Great Lakes winters. What was your experience like this winter, Paul?
Well, in Ottawa, yeah, it started off, we had a very warm fall, late fall, and then, you know, then we got quite a bit of snow. You know, it got a bit colder, but then, you know, it goes through these cycles. Then it gets very warm for a while, and then it gets very cold for a while, and then it gets very warm. So it's as the jet streams kind of sweep by. You know, if we're in the trough of the jet stream, then it's warmer than normal, and it could be, you know, 10 degrees Celsius or so. And then as the jet stream passes us and we come into the trough, then we're exposed to the cold Arctic air. And, you know, then it gets quite cold. And, you know, there's been many times this winter when it's been colder in southerly locations like Ottawa as compared to the Arctic, you know, the North Pole. I mean, the Arctic it's unbelievable how warm it's been this year. And the failure of the sea ice to form properly is being watched very closely, you know, and it's in the mainstream news stories and things like that as well.
Yes, indeed. When I look at the climate maps on places like climatereanalyzer.org, I see that there's a big red blotch of much warmer than normal up in the Arctic. And then there's actually a bluer section where I live on the western side of the continent saying it's a little colder than expected. So it almost seems like the heat went up there, and it's very unusual here, as you say, with the jet stream waggling around. Well, okay, here's my first personal trigger. I'm minding my own business, Paul. I'm cruising through gardening videos, and a listener sends me a story by journalist Nafiz Ahmed. He says new science suggests we could experience a burst of warming within the next 5 years. Now, I've had problems getting my usual garden plants to survive the strange hot May and June we had last year. The U.S. National Weather Service says this coming spring will be even hotter. It's going to be a struggle to garden. What do you think, Paul? Could we see an even worse jolt in heating, something maybe we haven't seen before, within the next 5 years?
Yes, I think it's very possible. In fact, you know, it's more than possible. It could even be likely. I mean, there's this index, it falls under the category of teleconnections indices. It's called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And basically, when it's in the positive phase, then a lot more heat is going into the atmosphere than in the oceans. And when it's in a negative phase, more heat is being stored in the ocean. So the so-called, you know, hiatus or stall in atmospheric temperature rise around the time of the late 90s with the very powerful El Nino that year, making it an exceptionally hot year that year. But for a while since then, more heat's been going into the ocean than in the atmosphere. So the atmospheric temperatures were rising about 0.1 degree per decade for that period of time, when normally they'd be about 0.15. And what we've seen recently is they increased to 0.2 per decade. And then if you look at just the last several years, we've had a 0.2 degree Celsius increase. So the latest numbers are that we're 1.25 degrees Celsius above the 1880 to 1910 or 1920 average. Now, in order to compare to the pre-industrial, which is 1750, you have to add another 0.3 degrees. So that gives you 1.25 plus 0.3 or 1.55 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial. And that was for the year 2016. So we're already above that 1.5 degree benchmark aspiration from the Paris Climate Agreement. And we're very rapidly approaching that 2 degrees Celsius. So if we continue to get rises of 0.2 degrees globally every few years, if that trend continues, clearly we'll be passing the 2-degree mark within 5 years if that trend was to continue. It looks like part of the reason for the large increase of 0.2 degrees in the last few years, you know, a big part of that reason was the very powerful El Nino that we had. And then we went into a La Nina, a bit cooler period, but that fizzled out very quickly. And the word is that we're moving back into another El Nino. So even the El Nino, La Nina cycles, which are, you know, they're from 2 to 7 years, they're a bit irregular. They seem to be leaning towards more powerful El Ninos, which are the warming part of the cycle versus the cooling part of the cycle, the La Nina. So, you know, it's certainly very possible that we can get this warming period. The PDO looks like it's shifting to give more air to the atmosphere. And this paper you're talking about was talking about the number of Hiroshima atomic bombs per second that were heating the ocean.
Wow.
Yes, if we want to use that type of metric, Hiroshima bombs per second, you know, a couple of decades ago, the warming in the oceans was about 2 bombs per second. And then in the last 17 years, it's doubled to about 4 bombs per second. In 2013, it tripled again, so that would be 12 Hiroshima bombs per second warming the oceans. The warming, everything seems to be accelerating rapidly in a highly nonlinear, exponential fashion with climate change. Whether you look at temperatures, global temperature warming, which we're talking about, if you look at greenhouse gas levels, the CO2 levels, you know, are regularly going up over 3 parts per million. Each year, and this is, as the International Energy Agency is saying, that our human anthropogenic emissions are somewhat stabilized, yet they're still, if the atmospheric levels are still going up, then that means that we're losing the sinks of CO2 on the planet, like the Amazon rainforest, boreal forest, etc. Phytoplankton are getting weaker, and the sources of CO2 from either permafrost and deep sea sediments, etc., are increasing, and that also includes, you know, methane as well. So we're in an emergency situation. Our climate is screaming at us, hey, humans, wake up. We have an emergency situation on our hands, and we need to take proportionate response to try to step back from the precipice. In fact, we've already gone over the precipice, and we're falling rapidly. So we need to be caught, arrested, and pulled back from the precipice. You know, we're certainly in this emergency situation. And this is why, you know, years ago, I was completely against things like, well, things falling under the umbrella of, quote, geoengineering. Carbon dioxide removal, not so much, but solar radiation management, yes. And this is why I've been pushing for this three-legged bar stool approach to dealing with our emergency situation.
Okay, now, so listeners can track this. The paper stimulating Ahmed's article, advice.com, was published back in 2015 with the title, quantifying the likelihood of a continued hiatus in global warming. And I'll put links to that in my blog at ecoshock.org. And I want to say, though, Paul, I began by moaning about personal triggers where the news gets too real. And judging by a recent video of yours, I'm thinking you hit one, too. And I'm talking about stories that billionaires expect to get away from climate collapse by building bunkers in the Southern Hemisphere in places like New Zealand. Maybe we'll all head to New Zealand. What's wrong with that logic?
The problem is that the extreme weather events in the Southern Hemisphere are just as bad, just as extreme as extreme weather events in the Northern Hemisphere, because we have a climate system. So, you know, some of these billionaires, they think, okay, well, we're losing the ice that's causing the disruption in, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere. We're losing the Arctic ice. So move to the Southern Hemisphere where the temperatures, you know, will be moderated somewhat by ocean temperatures and things like that. But the problem is the climate system is connected and they're just as much a part of it as us and will be affected just as much. Because as we lose Arctic sea ice and snow cover, the Arctic gets a lot darker, absorbs a lot more heat. So there's less heat moving from the equator to the Arctic. So the jet streams slow down and become wavier, and we get all these extreme weather events in the Northern Hemisphere. But because there's more heat at the equator, a lot of that heat goes into more evaporation of the water. So there's more clouds and more water vapor and more storms in the equator. But the heat also rises. And if you reach that wet bulb temperature of 35 degrees, then parts of the land surface become uninhabitable to humans. But that heat has to also go to the Southern Hemisphere, which it does. And if the equator's hotter, more heat's going to the Southern Hemisphere. It gets down to Australia, New Zealand region, causes very high temperatures there, but it also changes the wind patterns around Antarctica. It changes the sea ice formation around Antarctica, and the warm water, ocean water, is undercutting in Antarctica and melting a lot of ice there. So the problem is as the jet streams around Antarctica become much wavier, as they slow down with the warming of Antarctica, then they will actually reach up to areas like New Zealand and Australia. So there will be a lot more climate variability, weather variability, certainly in New Zealand and Australia as Antarctica warms and loses ice, both on land ice shelves, and sea ice. And we've seen record lows of sea ice in Antarctica this year. I mean, a couple of years ago, we had record highs in the sea ice around Antarctica. So we're getting these large gyrations in Antarctica, which we've been seeing in the Arctic. So we have a connected climate system that these people would be much better off hiring top PR firms, influencing politicians and government to declare a climate change emergency and get strong action. We're all in this boat together. You know, when the tide comes in, all boats rise. When the tide goes out, all boats fall. So they're just in bigger boats than the rest of us.
They do have some big boats. Some of them have 150-foot, 300-foot yachts, but there is not going to be any safe place to hide. We know that. Now, you raised one of the next topics I wanted to talk to you about, which is survivability at the tropics. I've had scientists on the show saying the tropics won't warm that much. The theory was that Earth had a sort of general thermostat, and the tropics are about as warm as they can get. But now Dr. Matthew Huber and his Climate Dynamics Prediction Laboratory have published a new paper saying there is no global thermostat. The paper, you may not have seen it, just came out March 3rd, 2017 in Science Advances. It says, evidence disproving tropical thermostat theory, global warming can breach limits for life. That's not what you want to hear, can breach limits for life. So they looked at the last great warming event, the Paleo-Eocene Thermal Maximum, the PETM, around 56 million years ago. And quoting from the abstract, it says, global ocean temperatures rapidly warmed by about 5 degrees C. That sounds pretty drastic, and I assume that can't happen anytime soon, but maybe the tropics will warm right out of control.
As you get warming of the surface of the ocean, of course, that water is much lighter. So it becomes very, very highly stratified on the ocean. So you get less mixing. So when we talk about warming of 5 degrees C, I mean, it's quite easy to see that the sea surface temperature can warm significantly. And the more it warms, the lighter it is and the more stratified it is. So this becomes not just an issue of the heat going into the ocean, but it's an issue with the vertical movement of water, so upwelling and downwelling in the ocean, which also depends on water currents and the geometry of coastlines and all these different factors. It also depends, of course, on the salinity of the water. So as we get more meltwater from Greenland, say, from Antarctica, and as that water is heated on the surface, then if there's less mixing, then it takes longer for that water, the fresh water, to be completely mixed to reach that sort of average ocean salinity of 35 parts per thousand or 3.5% of salt content. So there's a lot of different factors into play, but the heat capacity of water is enormous compared to that of air. So this is a concern. I mean, if all that heat that's been going into the oceans over decades, if more of that heat is released to the atmosphere, then that will cause a large jump in temperature. I mean, generally, when we talk about global average temperatures and stuff, we're talking about air temperatures because that's where we experience. Right. But we're getting more and more and better data from ocean temperatures through the water column. And we've got these Argo floats and we've got various sensors. So we're getting more data on those sort of profiles and we're seeing massive shifts in the ocean. And not only that, when there's less mixing, the pH of the ocean can drop significantly on the surface and not be mixed throughout the water column. So ocean acidification is a huge issue, and it's dropping to levels. We've already had declines of about 30% in the last few decades of the pH. So that's an increase in acidity in the ocean. So we're about 8.05, down from 8.2 about three decades ago or so. And when we hit 7.9, 7.8, then we take a big hit on the marine food chain. We're already seeing issues in certain locations where the Arctic Ocean, for example, is becoming much more acidic. And there was a recent paper out about that as well. So like all the physical factors from the planet are screaming at us that we have a climate change emergency. And of course, this leads some people to throw up their hands and say, look, there's nothing we can do. I mean, I call it the D&D crowd. We have the deniers. Right. And then deniers, when they say, OK, there's stuff going on, but then we can't do anything about it. And then we have the doomer crowd right on the other end of the spectrum saying, you know, we can't do anything about it, you know, and giving ridiculously short timelines for utter catastrophe and extinction and stuff like that. So I did a number of videos to try to point out that, you know, hey, it's not all black and white. There's gray areas in between. Right. The Earth is large. That you don't have a complete collapse simultaneously around the planet. You have different pressures occurring into different countries and different regions of the planet at different rates, depending on their latitude, depending on the resilience of the countries, depending on their level of, you know, what percentage of their income has been on food, for example. If it's half and food prices double, then your country's finished, right? Right. So, you know, and it ties into migration issues and things. It also ties into countries becoming, you know, the politics going to becoming more protectionist, you know, anti-immigrant sort of thing. I mean, we're seeing it all. It all fits into this big picture. You know, the root cause is this abrupt climate change that we're experiencing.
Yes, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, talking with our regular correspondent, Paul Beckwith. He teaches climate science at the University of Ottawa in Canada. His website is paulbeckwith.net. Well, Paul, I'm lining up another guest that may be closer to your own interests. He's in the Middle East, in Oman, to be exact, and so the connections are a bit dicey. But anyway, their team is exploring whether rocks cast up from the Earth's mantle might be able to absorb a significant portion of our emissions. And apparently the mantle rocks have been out of touch with our atmosphere for so long, these rocks are ready to absorb really big amounts of carbon. Have you heard about that?
I haven't heard about that specific study, but rocks are, during periods in the Earth's past history, when there's a lot of rocks exposed, then those rocks are weathered, and the weathering process absorbs CO2, reduces the CO2 levels in the atmosphere. But generally, this process is a very long time scale process. So can we increase the rate of reaction. So it's a chemical reaction. So higher temperatures, reaction rates increase. As you get larger surface area, the chemical reaction increases. So one of the ideas, for example, with olivine is a mineral in rocks which absorbs lots of CO2. So if you grind it up into a very fine powder, that greatly increases the surface area. And if you put this crushed powder on surfaces, on pathways, you know, on roofs, if you put it in the water, then it absorbs tremendous amounts of CO2. But you, of course, have to look at the whole energy budget of this because it takes a lot of energy to grind up rocks. Of course, there was the experiment in Iceland where you inject CO2 deep under the ground, and they found that it would turn into rock very quickly. They thought it would take decades to even centuries, and after a few years, a significant amount of the CO2 seemed to be trapped into rocks that were formed down underneath the ground in these deep mines. So the idea of bringing up rock from deep in the earth is the same sort of idea. It's how do we accelerate the weathering process? And there's a lot of research going into that. This fits under the umbrella of CDR, or carbon dioxide removal. I mean, personally, I think that the best options for carbon dioxide removal are to try to get some balance in the biosphere, because we have actually reduced the biomass on the planet significantly in the last 100, 200 years. And we've obviously gone overboard on animals, and we've degraded plants significantly. So if we could restore some of that balance, you know, for example, we've lost 90% of the large fish in the oceans. If we had that 90% back, that's an enormous amount of carbon that wouldn't be in the atmosphere, wouldn't be in the oceans, making them acidified. If we stimulated phytoplankton growth in massive amounts and then, you know, restored the web, the trophic webs in the ocean, that would be a way to have a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere ocean system. So these are things that we can do. I mean, we can't keep cutting down forests and replacing them with agriculture and things like that. You know, we have to look at these issues. There's no one solution to this, but these things all fall under the umbrella of carbon dioxide removal. It's sort of letting nature do what it normally does and actually enhancing the process and trying to accelerate it, because we are in an emergency situation.
What have you heard lately about the methane situation?
Yeah, methane, the levels are definitely going up in the Arctic regions, especially in regions where there used to be sea ice coverage at least part of the year, and now it's open year-round. I did a series of videos on looking at methods that naturally removed methane. So if methane was coming up from the seafloor, for example, how much methane would be broken down by bacteria, et cetera, microorganisms in the mud, in the sediments itself? How much would go into the water column as bubbles? How much would be broken down in the water column by aerobic respiration in the presence of oxygen? And how much would get into the atmosphere, et cetera? So I did a series of videos on this. So I think the point is, if there's very large episodic bursts of methane into the water column, then most of that methane makes it into the atmosphere. If the methane is coming out over vast areas, but, you know, in smaller amounts, sort of trickling out, then there will be a lot less of that methane getting up into the atmosphere in that scenario, because a lot of it will be broken down in the sediment and in the water columns. So it was looking at methane class rates in particular. It wasn't considering the methane on, of course, we know that the methane coming up from the permafrost, you know, is a huge threat. We see lots of slump and these methane holes, sort of the methane craters. You know, we see coastal erosion with the release of methane. We see all of these things happening. So I know there are some very interesting ideas looking at how can we break down methane better once it gets up into the atmosphere. I mean, naturally, the sun shortwave radiation has enough energy to break water molecules apart. It breaks the hydrogen off, so you have the OH-, and that's sort of the cleanser in the atmosphere, if you like. It reacts with methane, producing CO2 and water. I mean, the CO2 is not good, but the methane's at, you know, more of a part per billion level than a part per million level. So the CO2 produced when the OH minus hydroxide breaks apart the methane molecule, it's not the biggest concern because it's at a lot lower level. And of course, the global warming potential of methane is enormous compared to that of CO2. You know, even on a 100-year average time scale, it's 34 times, going to 86 times over 20 years, and probably 150 to 200 times more powerful than the CO2 molecule on a few-year time scale, which is the time scale that we should really be concerned about.
All right. Well, Paul, we're starting to run out of time for what I have this week. I've got two quick questions for you. And the first one is that what if the developing ecological reality becomes so terrible, so unreal, that even the scientists who have the facts start to look like end-of-the-world freaks? Maybe my listeners will get tired of it and drift away. Maybe you'll be banned from teaching new climate science at university. Are we already getting there?
I don't think we're there yet. You know, it's possible. I mean, it's a concern, you know, that we go there. But, I mean, the scientific community is generally pretty reserved and pretty quiet. And the U.S. political situation, there's a march of scientists coming up, you know, in sort of the end of April in the U.S., and I think it's going to happen also in Canada. I mean, in Canada, this is not new to us. We had Harper for 8 years. We had muzzling of scientists. We had a lot of problems, and scientists marched in Ottawa. There was 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 scientists that marched a few years ago. And, you know, most of the people in the U.S. aren't even aware that happened in Canada. You know, now we're seeing the equivalent thing happening in the U.S. So, you know, I think scientists are starting to realize that they can't just continue to do their business as usual, you know, be quiet and in the labs and just publish papers. I mean, more and more of them are coming out to speak to the media. You know, this is a problem. We don't have much choice. I mean, we have to try to do what we can. The scope of the problem is enormous, but we have to take steps and see what we can do to arrest and slow down the problem. So there's obviously a lot of different stages of emotions that come into play. We have to recognize that and think of strategies to deal with. Think of deniers and some of the strategies that they might use. I mean, they say, first of all, they say climate change isn't happening. And then if they agree it's happening, they say, well, there's nothing we can do about it anyway. And then there's the people that think we're too far down the path of abrupt climate change and we can't do anything about it anyway. So the net result is you have the D&D crowd are saying we can't do anything about it. And I just can't accept that. We haven't even tried to do anything on a really serious basis about this. Sure, renewable energies are growing in leaps and bounds. This is one aspect, but this is not sufficient. You know, we need to take CO2 out of the atmosphere. We need to look at deploy ways to cool the Arctic so we don't get this complete loss of Greenland ice and methane coming up and all the rest of it. So we're not defenseless. We can't just roll over. So, you know, I'm very hopeful that once we actually decide that, hey, you know, we have a real huge problem here, once we collectively as a society decide this, then we do everything we can to back away from the precipice. And that hasn't happened. So how can we possibly think about, you know, throw up our hands and say we can't do anything when this hasn't even been, we haven't even reached the stage yet. And right. So it doesn't make any sense to me. But, you know, it's understandable that there's people that go from, you know, that experience this range of emotions, I guess.
Yeah, well, I'm with you, Paul. I'm freaked out, but I'm not giving up, and I'm going to keep doing this program until people wake up to some degree or start to do something, and I think we will eventually. We've been talking with climate scientist Paul Beckwith. He's a generalist, really. He studies the big picture. He's an educator by day at the University of Ottawa, and he's a public educator all the time, providing science for the masses on YouTube. You can find all this at paulbeckwith.net. I'll put links to the science we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. And stay tuned for some in-depth interviews with some of those scientists. Paul Beckwith, I always appreciate your visits. Thank you for spending your valuable time with us.
Well, thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Thomas Crowther, I know it's exciting to discover results in science, but this is really bad news heaped on already bad news. Does it bother you?
I have to admit, sometimes it does. I really, you know, of course I want to understand the world, and if that understanding of the world can bring some sad news, then certainly it's not always enjoyable. And it seems very strange when you sort of celebrate a big discovery, but that discovery is about something so catastrophic for potentially for humanity. You know, it's a really serious impact. But what I would stress is that I do certainly see the positive side of this. I think if we're going to fight against something as considerable as climate change, the first thing we need to do is understand how considerable it's going to be. And once we get a handle on future climate conditions, and once we understand what the climate's going to do, it's only then that we can really set meaningful targets to fight against it. So I like to believe that this is certainly contributing to our fight against climate change.
What is your aim in philosophy? To show the fly the way out of the fly bottle. Are you a bad philosopher, then, if what you write is hard to understand? If you were better, you would make what is difficult easy to understand. But who says that's possible?
Would you like to rip fresh greens from your own backyard, even in winter? It sounds impossible until you get a tour of Caleb Warnock's winter garden. I just got his book about it. I'm not talking about greens in Florida or even in Vancouver. Caleb Warnock lives near Salt Lake City, Utah, with lots of altitude and lots of snow. He's the author of many popular books on self-sufficiency, healthy foods, and tips from the pioneers. Caleb Warnock, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
We can buy all sorts of greens and tropical fruits even, trucked in or flown across the ocean. Why should we go to a lot of work to grow our own food?
Well, I think if people are either sort of interested in this or they're not, they've already discovered that if you want to take control of your health and your budget, then you have to do some things on your own. You can't just rely on everyone else to do things for you. And I think the biggest reason, however, is flavor. Nothing that you can buy tastes like what you can grow.
And I think that flavor is telling us something, Caleb. I think that the vitamins and all the things that have been lost in shipping, and in fact, they just grow foods that will ship well and don't taste good. So there's a lot to be said for growing your own food.
Well, worse than that, they irradiate it, and you know, before it comes to the grocery store, they put all kinds of pesticides and insecticides.
Yep.
You know, herbicides, and they do all kinds of crazy things that, you know, you would never do if, when you're growing it in your own backyard. So it's better all the way around.
What drove you personally to rediscover lost skills and aim for better self-sufficient foods?
I was really lucky to have grown up in the last kitchens and gardens of the people who were really connected to the earth. I knew my great-grandparents on both sides of my family. I grew up with my great-grandparents on both sides of my family. This is how they lived every day. And, you know, as after I lost my great-grandparents, then I just wanted to keep doing what they were doing. I mean, I had wonderful memories of being in their gardens and eating in their kitchens. And the longer I have lived, the more I have discovered that there's just no equivalent to making it yourself, growing it yourself, or cooking it yourself.
One of your books is titled The Forgotten Skills of Self-Sufficiency Used by the Mormon Pioneers. Caleb, has a Mormon background helped you recover these lost skills?
Well, you know, you're either born with your background or you're not, and that book is not about religion, but these are the people that, you know, they came here into the middle of this crazy place where no one thought anything would ever grow, and they made it work. And those tips, those skills, those things that they knew how to do are almost gone today. And that's why so many people, I think, have responded to my books and my videos and my classes. And because we live in a world today where everybody has a skill or a thought or an idea in the internet, but a lot of that is not based in actual knowledge. Like, people are offering opinions about things that they've never done, never tried, when they offer photos from the first day of something instead of the fifth year of something, and So I think that's why people have responded, because this is the way our family lives every day. This is the way we have lived for years. And people, I know we've had thousands of people come here to our gardens and tour them. And when they see this working firsthand, I think they feel inspired. They feel like, oh my goodness, look how it's being done here at my house as compared to what we get out of the grocery store, or, you know, whatever the skill is. And this can be done. And this is the way it was done for thousands of years before the invention of the modern grocery store.
Well, this is one of the things I admire about your YouTube videos and now your book, and that is that when you make a mistake, you don't hide it. There's the photo of the dead plant, and you tell us what you did wrong and what you could do better next time. Do you have a couple of examples of epic failures that we can avoid?
I don't believe there is failure. I believe that there's honesty. I think what is missing today from the world, in great part, is people are very, if they think they have created something successful, they want to talk all about it, but they don't often want to talk about what it took to get from zero to success. And that's something that our ancestors would never have, I mean, they didn't consider failure to be a bad thing. They considered it to be an education, and I consider it to be an education. And I think people do a real disservice to people, especially in the homesteading community and the self-sufficiency community, when they want to go out and say, oh, look what I've done, and they don't want to tell people all the steps and all of the work that it took to get there. So to me, there's no failure about it. It's just like, for example, right now, one of the things that people are really responding to are my solar thermal and geothermal greenhouses. I have spent years now designing and redesigning and rebuilding, and now people come to my property in the middle of the winter, and I have four greenhouses that don't use any electricity or artificial heat. They're just completely heated by nature, and they walk in and they go, oh my gosh, who taught you how to do this? And I say, well, I taught me how to do this over the last 15 years. I taught me how to do this. I've spent lots of time and lots of money, and I don't consider any of my early attempts to be a failure. I consider it to be an education and necessary steps.
Well, this is one of the reasons I wanted your book, Winter Gardening, because I'm just about to build a geothermal greenhouse this coming spring, and I've been looking at all sorts of videos, of course, on YouTube. My plan is to lay about 300 feet of drainage pipe about 5 feet down with some gravel around it. And then I will probably use electricity and a fan to blow that earth cool when I need it in the summertime and hot, you know, when I need it in the wintertime. What did you do? What has been your most successful geothermal setup, let's say that?
Well, I hope I can be honest with you. What you have just described is not a good way to go about doing it.
Okay.
I hope that's not too blunt and too honest. And what you have described is exactly what people come up with when they do searching on the internet. And a lot of that information is from people who have not done it, have not tried it, and that method is extremely expensive. It'll never pay off in the end, and it doesn't, you know, we have to work hand in hand with Mother Nature. I think that's something that people have kind of lost sight of a little bit today, is that when you work hand in hand with Mother Nature, she will work with you. And we, for some reason as a society, we have started to, I don't know exactly where this comes from, but we want to fight Mother Nature every step of the way. And what you're describing is kind of a method of trying to, you know, fight a war against Mother Nature. And I've had a lot of people come to my classes and read my books. And my greenhouse classes are probably some of my most popular, most attended classes. I've had people fly in from Alaska to take my greenhouse classes because they build what you're describing and it does not give them the results that they want. And then they come to me and they say, okay, now how do I fix this? How do I make this actually work? That happened even yesterday. Somebody was putting a picture up on a Facebook homesteading group that I belong to saying, this is the existing greenhouse. It didn't work. It was a total failure over the winter. Now what do I do? It's a lot better to do it right the first time instead of spending a lot of time and money to discover that you're going to have to retrofit things.
Well, what should I be doing then?
Well, I mean, that's not a question that I can answer in 60 seconds, but, you know, I think what's important for people to know is that all of the commercial greenhouses that you see are not designed for winter growing because they do not have thermal mass. You can have a geothermal greenhouse or you can have a solar thermal greenhouse. I'm at 5,000 feet. My coldest temperature this winter was 19 degrees below zero. I have growing things in my unheated. I mean, the greenhouses are heated by the heat of the earth, and they have to be designed in a way where they can capture the heat during the day and release that heat during the night and rely on the heat of the earth during the night to keep the greenhouse from freezing. And that has taken a long journey for me to figure out how that can be done. But it is, once you figure out how to do it, it works gorgeously. And people, I have online classes about this. I have video tours about this. I think this is so important because people today have forgotten that before World War I, everyone grew food through the winter. Today we kind of think, oh my goodness, that's kind of like a parlor trick to grow food through the winter. We forget that if people didn't know how to grow food through the winter, we wouldn't be here today because they didn't have any choice or any option in the matter. You know, they perfected that skill and they perfected that art a long time ago, a long time ago. So it's not difficult and it's not hard. You just have to pay attention to the natural signs and be able to work together with Mother Nature.
Okay, now part of the challenge for folks with a greenhouse or with cold frames is to remember that in the northern hemisphere, I'd say August is the second planting season. And plants can often survive in the cold, but they don't grow a lot unless they get a good start. But Caleb, how do we get cold weather plants going when it's really hot out in the summer?
Well, the only thing that you need to start in the summer are things, and when we're talking at the very end of the summer, like the last week of July is when you want to start your root vegetables. If you're going to have root vegetables that you want to be able to harvest before December 31st, they need to be planted in the very last weeks of July and the first weeks of August. Everything else can be planted later. And it's just a matter at that point, they germinate pretty easily because the soil is pretty warm. At that point, it's just a matter of making sure that they don't dry out during the germination period.
The other tricky part about winter gardening, I guess, is to get actual growth. I've had experts tell me their winter greenhouse is like a vegetable storage place, and what you pick is always fresh. But have you found greens that can be cut and regrow again, even in cold and dim winter light conditions?
Well, that's all we do. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but after my first book became a national bestseller, I had a lot of the rarest seeds in the world because I had spent years reading books that were 300 and 400 years old and then having help with seed banks to track down the last of these seeds that have been going extinct. And today, because of all of that, because my book became a national bestseller, I own a seed company. And no one in the world has tested, I have so many varieties of the winter growing vegetables that don't exist anywhere else, that you can't buy anywhere else, because this is not a segment of gardening that anybody else has been focusing on. And so when you have the correct seeds and the correct plants, you have to remember that our ancestors were not growing the same things in the winter that they were growing in the regular growing season. So when you have the correct plants and the correct seeds, then you have success in the winter garden. And so, yes, every green thing that we grow is cut and come again. And all of the bulb varieties, like, for example, the best winter growing turnip is something called the Vertumaro turnip, which I'm the last grower of in the United States. And these are things that were widely available 200 years ago, even 150 years ago, but today they're almost extinct. And so you have to have the right things if you want to grow stuff during the winter. It's not, my greenhouses are not a food storage. And if you've seen my video tours, you know that that's not what's going on in my greenhouses, not in my cold frames, not in my all-natural hotbeds. We grow 365 days a year. I start seeds directly in the ground in every month of the year, just like the people who came before us used to do.
Do you want to give us a web address where people can get these seeds?
It's seedrenaissance.com.
Okay. Now, I just want to say, I spend most of my time interviewing climate scientists from all over the world. That's what I do on Radio EcoShock. And they're warning loudly that we may see even more heat waves than we've had. And you've worked on how to garden when it's too cold, but what about when it's too hot?
Yeah, too high. Well, last year, for the first time in history, I had in my garden 100-degree temperatures in the first week of June. And the National Weather Service in the United States, about a week ago, predicted that we're going to repeat that again this summer. Their prediction is that we're going to have the hottest, earliest spring on record. And if you don't know how to garden correctly, that can wreak havoc on your garden. When you're dealing with heat like that, you have to have short day count vegetables. And short day count vegetables are vegetables that go from seed to harvestability in a very short amount of time. Most of what is sold in the United States today is medium to long day count vegetables. But those don't do well in this kind of heat situation. And a lot of people struggled, at least in the western United States last year, a lot of people struggled because we had these temperatures that we had 100-degree temperatures in every week of June. And that's not typical or normal. And this year we may hit triple digits at the end of May is what they're predicting. So we have to change. We have to be able to adapt. One of the things that people have been responding to is that I've been teaching people how to plant food forests. Food forests are perennial vegetables, trees, bushes that you can put out, and then they follow Mother Nature's cycle and plant themselves from year to year. I have a garden that is 60% self-seeding and perennial in the summer and 80% in the winter, so that I don't have to go out and plant a lot of stuff every year. It just, this is the way that, you know, people gardened, you know, for most of history, is they weren't out there planting rows of things every spring, despite what the movies may show you. That's not how it was happening. They relied on perennial and self-seeding vegetables to feed themselves, and that's the way that successful gardeners will continue to go forward, because those vegetables plant themselves and reseed themselves at the moment they need to, working on Mother Nature's schedule without humans trying to guess when the best time is to do that.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest from Utah is Caleb Warnock. Now, you could call it permaculture, what you've just talked about, I think, or you could call it old school gardening, but can you tell us, what is the prepping or self-sufficiency scene like in Utah?
Well, I may not be a good person to ask about that, because I tell everyone who will listen that we should stop being prepared and start being self-reliant. One of the things that really concerns me is that people think that preparedness means putting thousands of dollars worth of freeze-dried garbage into some dusty storage bin, and then they don't feel that they need to learn to grow something on their own. And I'm sort of famous for telling people that when the zombie apocalypse happens, if I have to live on freeze-dried garbage, I'm going to run out and ask the zombies to eat me first, because that's not something I'm willing to do. I think that we need to have preparedness in the form of self-reliance today. A lot of people think that they can just spend money and put something away, but that is not self-reliance. And I'm also kind of famous for telling people that I don't care about you, but I do care about your children and your grandchildren. I think that we are doing a huge disservice by not. We teach our children and our grandchildren the fine art of living off of a credit card and watching the video games and watching television, and we don't get them out into the garden. They can't tell a weed from a vegetable. They don't know. If worse came to worse, they wouldn't know how to grow anything in the most ideal growing conditions, let alone the more difficult growing conditions, let alone in the winter or anything like that. And that's not their fault. That's our fault for not teaching them those skills. And I really feel strongly, and I'm very passionate about the fact that our kids and our grandkids are going to need some self-reliance skills, and that we are doing them a disservice when we don't take the time to teach them those things. So stop preparing, stop buying garbage to put away, get out into the garden and plant something, even if it's just a raspberry bush. I like to tell people, just even if it's if you do nothing else, children will respond to raspberries and strawberries, and they will grow up remembering that at least there was something edible within their space.
Do we need a few acres and a homestead to grow food, or can our listeners really do very much in their backyards or, say, in a community garden?
What a waste of space it would be to have. I have lots of friends who have lots of acres. I had someone who was talking to me yesterday who has 150 acres, and they are completely overwhelmed and lost and have no idea what to do. My wife and I live on an acre and a third, and we use about a third of that as far as growing goes. Again, this goes back to the way this has been done historically. Nobody historically was feeding their family on these huge tracts of land, because every square foot of land has to be correctly managed. So they knew how to grow a lot of food in a small space. I was accused once, after someone had come to tour one of my greenhouses in the winter, I was accused of they went on social media and openly accused me and my family of secretly being on food stamps and on welfare, because they said there's no way that Caleb could be feeding himself and his family on this small, in this small of a greenhouse through the winter. And that just, we still laugh about that at my house, because that just shows what an absolute lack of knowledge they have. Because people assume that you grow a head of lettuce and then you rip the whole head of lettuce out of the ground, and so they see that there's 20 heads of lettuce in my greenhouse in December, and they think I have 20 heads of lettuce, when in fact you cut the head of lettuce and it grows right back within 3 weeks. So it's a rotation. That's the way people have fed themselves. We know how, and I've actually written a whole book called Tiny Garden, Huge Harvest, because doing it on a smaller scale is the way to be successful. Getting 150 acres is not the way to be successful. Nobody can manage 150 acres without a tractor and gasoline and all kinds of things that have not been used throughout the history of the world.
You've also written a book called Stress-Free Vegetable Gardening. Can you share a couple of tips to avoid working too hard for those veggies?
Yes, I'll give you a tip. I think one of the most important things is that people should know is, as soon as the ground thaws out, there's a whole host of things, because right now, where I live, the ground is beginning to thaw out. So I have an email newsletter, and I just sent out my newsletter telling everybody, as soon as the ground thaws out, here's an entire list, vegetable by vegetable, of things that we should be planting now, especially this year when we're going to have an early spring. For example, if you want to do rutabagas, they have to be planted within the next week, or they will not produce a bulb successfully this year if they're not planted within the next week. Carrots and parsnips need to be planted immediately, because carrots and parsnips both have a longer germination time, and they need some colder temperatures, and they need continual moisture. And so now is the time to plant, you know, probably 40 to 50 things that I listed in my email, so that you don't have to water them. All you have to do is either throw the seed out or lightly rake it in and let Mother Nature take care of it, because there will still be rains. The soil is moist right now, and these are vegetables that need cooler soil temperatures in order to successfully germinate and to start make something edible before the tremendous heat comes, and it is going to come.
And I'd like listeners to know about the range of books that you've written. Do you want to tell us a few titles, including a couple on the specialty foods that you have explored?
Specialty foods, that's a funny term. I think you're probably referring to I have a book called The Art of Baking with Natural Yeast. We only use natural yeast. Most people don't know that all the yeast that you buy today in the grocery store has been genetically modified and is patented, and you don't have to take my word for that. You can go look up all of the patents for it. The natural yeast has not been sold in the grocery store for decades, and natural yeast, because it was created through a process of gene mutation called mutagenesis, no longer amidates the gluten that is naturally found in wheat and is making everybody sick. So natural yeast will make regular wheat flour safe for people to eat without gluten intolerance or celiac disease. I have a couple of books on herbal medicine. We have all kinds of books on gardening and mindful meals. And I don't know, I've written, right now there are 19 books that are available. There are more that are coming out. I have a book that I'm very proud of on stevia. Stevia is an herb, a green herb that has very sugary leaves, that is the answer to a lot of problems that people are having today health-wise. I'm a huge believer in stevia. I've been growing stevia for years, and a lot of people have no idea what stevia is or how to use it, and so I wrote a whole book on that. It's the first book of its kind that's ever been published, and I continue today to go out and, you know, even last night I was researching chia seeds, and there's actually a version of the chia seed that grows wild where I live, and, you know, these things are very difficult to come by, but I'm managing to get my hands on some, and I just continue to explore. I've been teaching homesteading classes for people, and you know, I'm interested in anything that we can do to make our lives easier and to make ourselves more self-reliant. But again, my mantra is to make sure that our children and our grandchildren are going to be prepared to live the life. A lot of people say to themselves that they have passed on the most important values of their ancestors to their children. But if you stop and think about that, that is not true. And I'm very concerned about that.
Okay, so how do we connect with you, Caleb? Do you have a blog? Do you have a Facebook page going? How do we get this newsletter? Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm on Facebook. You can find me on Facebook. Just type Caleb Warnock into Facebook, and I will be there. And my website is seedrenaissance.com. You can sign up for my newsletter at seedrenaissance.com. And there's usually free offers in most of my books that, you know, I send free seeds and yeast and all kinds of things to tens of thousands of people. So it's not too hard to find me.
Great. Well, I just got one of them from Utah. We've been talking with the best-selling author, Caleb Warnock. I've been lurking around his YouTube videos and blog, and I just ordered his book on backyard winter gardening. And you can find links for all of this in my weekly Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.org. Caleb, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I'm going to wrap up with something completely different. This song, Blindsided by Taylor Barton, sounds Christian, but it also has a climate side as she sings, "Someone Torched the Kingdom." Thank you for listening. Let's meet again next week.
In a floor below, but in hopes, newfound dreams, someone torched the kingdom. The steeple went up in a ball.